Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way.
All right, welcome back to a new edition of the Main Course OG. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. Thank you, Engineer Vitor. Get a pork chop for that.
Engineer Vitor.
That was, you just heard, Rocket 88, which was recorded, I believe, in Sun Studios in Memphis, and it is argued that it is the first rock and roll song ever recorded, which is ironic because this is the first show to ever record in Heritage Radio Network.
I don't think that counts as irony, actually.
That's not irony. Is it a metaphor? A simile? Did it say like or as?
It's a reach.
It's a reach. Well, I will say, you know, and since we very first started, you know, there are a lot of other media sources out there, some of which deal primarily with food. You know them, Eater, and then there's magazines. And something about this show, this network, from our first show that started in 2009, all the shows are good. All the people are good. They're fighting for causes. It is really impressive, like, what a good group of people have been attracted to the station. But it all started with Rocket 88. And what's his name? The drummer. Or he wasn't even the drummer.
Ike Turner. I believe played guitar on that.
It was all inspired by the goodness of Ike Turner. Well, I'm very excited to be here. I am in studio with point guards Elizabeth Greeley and Emily Pearson.
Hello.
Morning.
I hope you guys have all atoned for all the pork you've eaten this year. I am in studio with Mike Edison.
Hello.
Host of Arts and Seizures, which just finished broadcasting its 250th episode.
It was a good run.
And one of my favorite people of all the people I've met, Neil Kleinberg.
Hello.
Co-owner of Clinton Street Baking Company and Community Food and Juice. All right, Libby, take it over. Emily, take it over.
So we have an exciting show today. From Bert and Ernie to Hog Lagoons, we really cover a lot of different topics. So hope you're ready. So from Eater, people feel Instagram is effectively ruining the art of sushi. And at this point, there's little the master chefs can do about it. Ask any top sushi chef who's really studied the craft, and they'll tell you the window to eat a perfect piece of sushi is 3 seconds. In fact, chefs often joke the best way to serve a piece of sushi would be directly into the patron's mouth. So that's up close and personal. But people are wasting time taking photos, and sushi chefs are adding spectacles to traditional preparations for photo-friendly shots. So should phones be banned from restaurants and other dining areas? How do we feel about this?
Mike?
I think it's weird that you say they're taking photos, so should phones be banned? This is an oddly modern look at things, that you want photos to be stopped taking, so you're going to ban the phones. Now, can you imagine saying that 10 years ago
that's or 20? True, that's
20,
true.
20 years ago? 3 second sushi rule is idealistic at best. Okay, so I can't take out sushi. I can't take out sushi anymore either. They're gonna stop doing that. I think.
But you're not taking out like omakase single pieces meant to be presented at the perfect temperature, and you sit in front of the sushi chef and eat it.
Okay, in that case, I'm gonna say no. That's not the photo opportunity. But I think taking pictures of food is okay. I think there should be no flash photography in restaurants because that's it's not respectful of other patrons. But if you want to take a picture of your wonderful food and share it on Instagram, I think most restaurants like it because you're tagging them and you're promoting them. And Instagram functions sort of as a travel magazine, as a culinary magazine in many cases. And I see things on there that make me, that give me ideas of places I want to go and visit. So I'm saying, yes, take pictures, but with respect. There's got to be a strong etiquette. And that's what's lacking is the etiquette and civility.
Neil, what do you think?
I agree. I'm on my way to Tokyo in the first week of October to visit our location in Tokyo and Nagoya of Clinton Street. And I've been to many sushi places in Tokyo, you know, brought by my partners. And I find the sushi chefs there love it. And they're honored by it. It's not something that you shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. They're real masters there. And, you know, I'm like in total awe. I sit at a sushi bar and I watch these guys literally, you know, construct these beautiful pieces of things and put it in front of you, and you're eating them and you're like swooning and you're closing your eyes. And they love it when anyone takes a picture of their stuff. The last time I was in Tokyo, I was taken to a sushi bar and the chef pulled out a fish that was live.
Oh my gosh.
And he put it in front of me on a beautiful wooden plank and he smacked its head.
Which is the best way to go if you're a fish.
Yeah.
Versus being killed, you know,
exactly,
in a
with a hook
way.
And the blood
or in
and
the net
guts.
For five
and,
hours.
And he basically, you know, prepared this beautiful piece of sashimi for us right in front of me from its, you know. Mm-hmm. From its tank or wherever it was from. But it was, you know, they love the showmanship. They love their respect for their craft. Mm-hmm. And
well, absolutely.
I agree with Mike, you know, as long as it's done, you know, in a respectful manner.
No, and I would agree. And I would think, you know, these days, Instagram can be your best PR. It could be terrible, but it could also be your best PR. And it's you want your crowdsourcing photos of people showing eating a biscuit at Clinton Street,
right,
or something at Community Food and Juice. I guess the question is more if it lessens the quality. It seems that this article was also skewed towards New York City, and it was not the, you know, Tokyo sushi masters,
right,
where it is just the single piece. This was saying putting uni on uni on uni on uni to make it like look wow, but not actually taste that good.
I once read a book called Highbrow Lowbrow, which I quote a lot. And, you know, in the old days, this is regarding the theater, but maybe it applies to food too. Theater in the U.S., the you would go to a theater and they would perform Shakespeare, these traveling troops, and the audience would scream at the stage, you know, the actors, and be like, you didn't do that scene good enough. And they knew all the plot lines, and they were, you know, the liminal space between performer and audience was obliterated, and everyone was screaming, oh, you're doing it wrong, and, you know, laughing and all that. And then something happened in the beginning of the 20th century where, you know, this kind of American idea, we have to be like Europe and we have to be absolutely quiet. And so they started acting like what they thought was Europe. But in reality, Europe, they throw tomatoes at Pavarotti when his voice started to go. They weren't that kind of thing.
It's not actually Europe. It's this perception of European
what it
culture.
Is. Yes.
And it's absolutely not true. Like,
I wonder if that's the same with food, where we're like, we shouldn't take a photo. Why not? I'm sure Europeans have like...
Listen, you grew up in a classical music-loving family. You've been to the symphony many times. There's no applause between you know, the acts of an opera or whatever. You wait to the end. Supposed to wait to the end. And if you do clap...
You hear one guy go like this, but
that's
no one
D-class
else does.
A. Yes. But people normally used to applaud.
Of
like after like a, you know, the beautiful adagio, people would stand up and give a standing ovation, and the orchestra would wait before they played the final movement.
And I'm not joking about Pavarotti, an American hero, being booed because they're like, we loved you, but you're not you anymore. You have to stop singing in public.
And jazz as well. If you've ever been to a jazz concert recently, it's treated like a library. You know, you're supposed to sit there like a mummy, you know, watching people perform with no interaction between the audience and the performers. Yeah. When what you want to hear is hooting and hollering.
Of course,
and
it pumps up the performers.
And some of the most avant-garde, far-out, revered performers, you know, in the world that I've got to meet say, we miss that. We miss people hooting and hollering when things get heated on stage. We like it.
And as you said, it's just the perception of what Europe is. So if you're like, oh, we're not supposed to take photos, you're not supposed to be talking on the phone. Sure, but take all the photos you want. Flash, no flash. That's part of the spectacle.
And on the other thing,
you're paying
$300. I hear a lot of criticism of Bob Dylan, who's coming to town again. He's on tour as always. And he has a very hardcore zero tolerance policy for cameras and phones. Okay, they will throw you out. If they catch you with your phone on, they will throw you out of the auditorium and they let you know that. And I think it's great because I'm watching a Bob Dylan concert and it's quiet, it's noir, and the guy next to me has got his phone on. It's a fantastic distraction. I paid a lot of money for this ticket. And he doesn't allow...
But I can take a photo of my food next to you?
As long as it doesn't have a flash on it, as long as you're not getting, you know, it's a little bit different. I agree with it. And then the crazy thing is, though, when I read reviews of Bob Dylan, the people who invariably say these draconian, you know, Bob Dylan phone Nazis, right? I mean, God forbid they should read a real freaking Nazi. You know, there are always, always like 20-year-old kids who are complaining. Older fans are like, this is really cool because I'm not staring at the back of someone's phone.
And by the way, back to the sushi thing. If the sushi chef does want you to eat in 3 seconds, absolutely feed it into my mouth. I mean, he should just be like, this is going straight in. No photo on this.
Coming in.
Yeah.
You know, the whole Instagram thing, I think, has gotten out of hand in the way when you almost bastardize the whole thing about the simplicity of sushi or sashimi or the way it's cut. Mm-hmm. When you pile up 15 pieces of sushi with uni and... The same thing, you know, when they do it with a chocolate chip cookie and they put 20 in a row. And I think that's not cool. And I think that's does the restaurant that they're promoting a disservice, because then people, you know, then the people coming out and they're saying, oh, where's that stack of 1,500 pancakes with maple syrup, you know, running down instead of, a perfect stack.
Perfect cookie.
Perfect something. Made deliciously and eaten for its, you know, pure pleasure.
Well, who was that? And then we can go to the next one, the highbrow concept of mayo chup. But I think Michelangelo, or was it Leonardo da Vinci, was bidding to get commissioned to do this art piece, like a big gate or door or something like that. And one guy who was competing against built like this big gate, and he spent thousands of hours. Leonardo or Michelangelo just came to the thing where they were testing. They were like, so where's your piece? Where you're bidding for this? And he just drew a perfect circle in front of everybody. And it was such a perfect circle. They're like, you get the job for sure. The other guy was like, mwah.
Simplicity, I see.
Right. Less is more.
Yes.
Speaking of, there's
This is
more is more, I guess, according to Heinz. Mayo chup. The terribly named mayonnaise ketchup combo from Heinz is due to arrive in American grocery stores this month. What do we think? I mean, it's just Russian dressing, right?
Exactly.
It's just Russian dressing. Is Russian dressing have anything else in it?
Relish, right?
Yeah.
I think.
Worcestershire.
So I don't. I can't. I'm actually in shock that Heinz didn't already have this particular product. I mean, where does it vary between like Thousand Island dressing and also you can just buy. They would make better money selling you ketchup and mayonnaise and making you do it yourself versus you now buy one and you only get one condiment instead of three.
We have a sandwich at Clinton Street we run like seasonally. It's called the Real Turkey Sandwich. So it's turkey, Swiss, coleslaw, rye bread on our homemade Russian dressing. Ketchup, mayo, Lower East Side sour chopped pickles, Worcestershire, Tabasco, salt, pepper. That's it. So we make our own dressing. For them to do it for you in a mixed bottle is, you know, my mother-in-law would buy that.
And I guarantee you the first...
mother-in-law.
I guarantee you the first ingredient is going to be high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah. You're taking everybody down. Your bio takes down your mother and for what she cooked. And then now you just took down your mother-in-law.
I'm taking down everyone.
No your one was bio, a worse cook than my mother.
And mother-in-law.
Okay, God rest her soul.
Famous chicken dish. Chicken in a pot. The only dish in her repertoire. This is your bio.
She was a working mom. She potted everything. She put everything in there. Potted meatballs, potted chicken, potted steak.
She knew how to use a pot.
Now, Mike, you liked
the... She didn't know how to smoke it, but she knew how to use it.
You liked the peanut butter and jelly combined.
I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was... I don't know. That guy was smoking some pot when he thought of that. I thought that was great. It was like, you know, this is good for astronauts who can't be bothered with like jars of peanut and jelly.
So mayo chop is not... Mayo chop's not good for astronauts?
My thoughts on the mayo chip is like, really, who gives a fuck? I mean, it's Heinz. It's, you know, they're just going to throw out a bunch of junk for a bunch of stupid Americans to buy. They're going to put it on the shelves. The market will decide whether they want it or don't want it.
I think it's hilarious. I want this to be on the table.
And you elitist Brooklyn foodies can laugh all you want, and we'll see if they sell it next year's Super Bowl.
I want it to be on the table. You have your mustard, ketchup, and then mayo chup. Yeah, mayo chup.
I don't eat crap to begin with, so this doesn't really come onto my radar. It's not something that would ever come into my house under the best of circumstances or worst of circumstances. So, you know.
What about ranch? Do you eat ranch?
That was a big article. I'm not a ranch. It's Ranch Nation.
But I do know that it's that. There's like a literal cult surrounding ranch dressing.
Yeah.
It was a big thing in the Times, the food section of the Times. I found it very boring and uninspiring.
Well, honestly. I mean, it's interesting that ranch more than other ones. What's Thousand Island? Does it really come from a thousand different islands?
I think it's a version of Russian dressing. Isn't it just mayo and ketchup?
What makes Russian dressing? Why is it? What's French dressing? What's Russian dressing? Yeah. What's ranch?
Yeah. I think Hidden Valley took the name on one, and another company took the name on the other, and they just sort of...
Made it out of ketchup.
Yeah, ketchup and mayo. But this whole ranch thing, by the way, like I went to school in Michigan, and everyone in the Midwest loves ranch. And I did not grow up with that here in New York. Like, it was not a popular thing. But everyone likes to dip their French fries.
One of my favorite things, Ann and I, my favorite things to do is when we go out to the Midwest, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, anywhere, and they're like, list you 15 dressings that are basically all ketchup and mayonnaise. And we're like, oil and vinegar. Right. And occasionally you'll get a... I'll go see if we have that. I'm like, I think you have that.
Yeah, but you're the jerk who goes to Baskin Robbins and makes them name all the ice cream flavors and then orders vanilla.
I'm like, what's your good 30-second flavor? I'd like a 30-second flavor. Doesn't Baskin and Robbins pride themselves on having 31 flavors?
36. Oh. 31.
31?
Yeah.
31.
I know.
Dang.
Yeah. I do taste a lot of ice cream. And like still at my age, it's a little foolish.
Do you purchase one at the end?
Of course. It's a big decision.
You sure? Maybe she just tastes and it. She's like, I've had enough. Time. I mean, I like 16 handles. You go and you like figure out what you want and you have a little of each.
No, we're not allowed to go to that place in my family.
There's one on the Upper West Side.
I know. We're not allowed to even walk on that side of the street.
You can't look at it.
No.
I happen to.
Well, the whole thing with the ranch versus the Russian, I grew up in like a Jewish Brooklyn household with 16 cousins and all these aunts and uncles. Uh-huh. And it was, a ranch wasn't allowed. It was like a Goyim thing.
It was
a non-Jewish Texas thing. But Russian, that was good. Russian dressing.
The ingredients. So the same
and mustard.
Deli mustard, you know, mayo. If you put mayo on a corned beef sandwich,
goyish crap, Jesus
Christ. It. Unbelievable.
If my grandmother ever saw me put French's, that yellow mustard, that goyish crud in my mouth, she'd be rolling over in her grave.
Basically, it's Gulden's, right? It's like a Gulden's is a deli mustard. It's like granular.
Gulden's is one step in the right direction.
Right,
but Mark Radner says Gulden's is the best mustard ever invented.
Shoshanda.
Now, making your own mayo or Hellman's? I know I heard Alice Waters and Joyce Goldstein, James Beard's old assistant, get into it. And Joyce Goldstein was like, just buy it. And Alice is like, you must make your own.
If I'm going to have mayo.
I like Hellman's too. We use Hellman's in the restaurant for a few things, okay? We don't make homemade mayo to make our tartar sauce, which we go through like 10 gallons a week of tartar sauce for the poor boys. But if we're doing shrimp cocktail for a really nice party and we'll do like a garlic aioli or a garlic mayo as a dip or something, we'll make the mayo from scratch.
Right.
Because you want to impart like roasted garlic or lemon or something in there, or an herb. But if you're making a tuna fish sandwich, it's Hellman's. Or if you're making a BLT on rye toast, it's Hellman's.
Absolutely.
To me.
I'm with you. All right, keeping in the large companies making decisions for us, like Heinz, we're going on to Coca-Cola. Soft drink behemoth Coca-Cola is taking a look at the market for cannabis beverages, reports Bloomberg this week. The Atlanta-based company is reportedly considering, quote, drinks infused with CBD, the non-psychoactive ingredient in marijuana that treats pain but doesn't get you high. Coke is eyeing Canadian marijuana producer Aurora Cannabis as a partner to create this new line of products.
I love that they say hi.
Yeah. Well, when they put the cocaine back in Coca-Cola, call me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have a tradition of that, right? Cocaine, and now they're back to something like that. That's cool. And plus, Coke by itself is so
pleasurable. No, it's not cool. It's anything but cool. Dude, why would you go to Coca-Cola to get something medicinal? Like why would you trust them to give you CDBs? Like, why?
Why would they do wrong with
that? That's not their, they're not a farm. They're not. If you want to buy CDBs,
you think CBD is a pharmaceutical?
Let me tell you something. If you're using it, we've been having this conversation. We talked to it about Brandon last week and some of our other friends who are
he's on it all the time.
In pain. Yeah, and he buys it from a reputable source. He knows where
Coke
he's getting
CBD
from. Coke is
reputable. They're competing.
They're going to buy their cannabis product.
If you're doing
them.
It to treat pain, but then you're drinking like high fructose, you know, like Coca-Cola, which is like sugar, and that is funny, actually.
I don't know that the combination is right, but I mean, let's do our homework. Aurora Cannabis and Coca-Cola is.
But what's the difference?
Why wouldn't it be?
What's the difference between sugar the sugar high and the marijuana high.
Well, this isn't psychoactive. There's no THC in this product. It's using the CDB, which is the cannabinoid. It's the part of the marijuana that's not psychoactive, but it supposedly has therapeutic effects. And people have reported very positively on it, though there's no, I don't think there's any yet peer-reviewed scientific research.
So what, like reduce pain or reduce swelling or things like that?
Inflammation's
so take a couple of Advil. You know, you need to drink a Coke with your Advil.
Apparently Advil has more long-term effects on your gut, although sugar and all the Coca-Cola products probably have some long-term effects on your gut.
I think it's great. And also Coke is reputable. I mean, it's a delicious drink. Also, you know, we're drinking martinis all the time. And so my kids are at the thing. They're 5 and 6 years old. I'm at a dinner drinking 2 gin martinis, Gibson's, and I'm telling them to drink water. No, they can have a Coke only when we're out, but they should be allowed to have Coke. It's a delicious drink. I would trust them. And shit, if it makes me feel calm and all that, and also
tastes
delicious.
But then do you think there's
going to
be an age disclaimer? So like the way you can't buy cigarettes until you're 18, can you not buy a Coke with...
No, that's a good question.
Well, who's the customer for this?
And what are they going to call it? Coke what?
Coke
CBD. High.
Coke high.
You know what I mean?
Well, okay, I think they're just doing this because the soda market is going down. Because they introduced all those other flavors like lime Coke and like, isn't there like a mango one?
You weren't even alive for New Coke.
Yeah,
we saw that was one of the worst mistakes of all time.
Horrifying.
Which didn't work.
And then Classic Coke.
And then they had to and then they were like, we're sorry.
But to me, this is just another example of this large corporation trying to co-opt a trend that is, you know, intended to be healthy and organic and safer than, you know, big pharma. And they're just co-opting it the same way, you know, the man always steals from the underground. You know, like I said, you know, hip hop was jungle music until they figured out they could sell soda pop with it, you know? Same thing with punk rock, same with every single art movement. It's always been co-opted the second someone saw a real profit in it above, you know, the underground level. And that's all that's happening here.
Well, good for Aurora Cannabis, though. They're going to be making a lot of money off of this, that company.
So in our next story, pig prices, commodity pig prices are rising. Aren't you happy, Neil, that you don't buy commodity pork? The prices would have doubled.
We don't buy enough of it. But we did meet that farmer at your house.
David Newman.
Yeah.
He still talks about you.
And what about, how does it affect him?
Nothing. We're out of the system. We're off the grid.
Perfect.
Well, because this, according to Bloomberg, there have been at least 2 breaches of hog manure lagoons in North Carolina amid the record-setting floods that have been unleashed by deadly Hurricane Florence, according to the state agency. So we've talked about these pig lagoons before in North Carolina.
So they've just dumped the water level. Now those pig lagoons, there's shit everywhere.
So should food cost more so that the companies can deal with the waste of their livestock, sewage treatment plants, the waste cities do? But is food too expensive already, or is that even where they would put the money?
There shouldn't be shit lagoons. I mean, pigs should not be raised in these enormous houses and just on a feeding assembly line and with their shit. I mean,
I did read
the article, and I was relieved to at least hear that it says that they are lined pits, because there's been issues over the years where there are some that are not lined, and then it seeps into the soil.
Well, now it's seeped everywhere.
Now it's seeped everywhere. So, and they said of the 4,000 lagoons, 3,000 were absolutely unaffected, but there's a chance that the other 1,000 were, and then I read that Smithfield had to close one of their plants for a few days. So now I'm thinking, is there a shortage? You know, they kill 19,000 pigs a day.
The top brass at Smithfield are bad people. They're bad people. They're bad people that shouldn't be, you know, no show and tell. They're not in schools. They're just bad people. They're hurting our kids. And this is an example. You have to deal with pig waste the way cities deal with human waste. There's more pigs in those big areas than they are people in big cities anyway. And to think that they could get away without not doing that. I mean, I think it's a Republican thing. I think basically Democrats would be for kind of hip checking those companies that make billions of dollars a year to have to deal with that stuff. And I think Republicans, are like, hey man, it's the free market. It's the free market. And that's not a long-term solution. And I love what Bloomberg said. He said, how on earth could I run as a Republican nowadays? The Republicans must be punished for their collective stance on the environment and for a bunch of other issues. And I agree. This is an example. You have to hip check. You don't end their careers, but you hip check them to have to deal
Make
with stuff like this.
Make them pay for the money they've made.
Yeah. I think a lot of these companies for these pig lagoons are Chinese owned. So they're not even owned in by U.S. Smithfield companies, bought them, yeah. And then, so why do they care if they're even polluting?
Yeah.
It's one. But on that better note, they are winning. Some of the neighbors are winning, or at least fighting and getting recognition to against like the pig lagoons, that it's bad for the environment and around. And
well, this pig effluence has been a problem for many, many years. Yeah. And you've heard me say it before. If you knowingly poison a river, you should be put in jail for the rest of your life. That's it. I mean, it's insane. It's the very definition of sane. It's really, you know, it's spoiling your nest. And it's
people get cancer. You know, I mean, these are terrible
people. And, you know, and like, oh, yeah, because it's cheaper to pay the fine than it is to, you know, keep the river clean. Yeah. It's cost of business. It's sick. And then, I mean, it's the very definition of, like, sociopathic, and it really is.
And I'll say this about, you know, the Republicans, they'll always be the white supremacists. That contingent's all existed throughout history. But it is the, you know, what I call the McCains of the world, you know, the buttoned-up ones, the nice ones, you know, that say, oh, I don't know much about that, or that's not in my backyard, so I have no opinion on that. It basically means that they are knee-deep in shit, they stand for nothing, and they don't stand up for causes. Because, yes, this is upsetting, and it'll be forgotten about in 2 weeks, you know, and that's also upsetting. You have to vote for parties that deal with it. And if the Republicans want to stay legit, the Mitt Romneys of the world have to redefine it and, you know, lose a couple of elections until they start to play ball with science and things like that. It's upsetting.
Yep.
I don't know. I've never actually seen one. Only in photos.
What? Pig?
Pig lagoons.
Well, can't see them because they don't let people on the farm.
Right, well, but the Kennedys are doing great stuff, eating animals.
Was it the Waterkeepers Alliance? Is that's shown Kennedy's, in the film, eating animals.
They pay for helicopters to fly over.
I think also drones. I mean, I don't think those factory farms are thrilled to have people taking photos from, you know, aerial photos.
The way you said it was like, oh, I've never seen that, but there's a reason no one has seen it except on these movies.
Well, they make it illegal to take photos.
Yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, it's all kept...
Bad people.
All right, our pigs aren't like that.
Companies like Smithfield that are making all this money off their product should be responsible for cleaning up these wastes.
It's called sewage treatment
plants. Well, they should be responsible for doing it properly.
For their infrastructure, they should be paying for it.
I mean, the other option would be to spread... the shit to raise fewer pigs in any one area. So that they'll never do because of cost of efficiencies and stuff. So when you have that many pigs in such a small environment and you can smell the place from 50 miles away, you got to deal with that.
Well, and then in the film Eating Animals, Waterkeepers Alliance shows that they then set up a spray system. Because you can't just come
in. Eliminate the smell.
They don't have a truck coming in and draining the pools. Yeah. So instead, they have a spray system spreading out this, you know, pink shit pool.
And then they showed the thousands of dead fish in the lakes all around there. I mean, just dead fish, like blood, lesions, pus things. I mean, come on.
No, it's disgusting. The people who pollute should be put in
eating
jail,
animals. Period. It's a great movie to see about that.
And Neil's absolutely right. They should be paying for their own infrastructure to clean up their own goddamn mess. The same as when there's an oil spill, too.
Of course.
I want to see. I mean, I can't believe, like, you know, the Exxon Valdez, and I'm still just like, years later, I'm still mystified that you could spill that much oil and the United States government sits around and watches it, says, clean up your own mess. You know, they should send in the Army Corps of Engineers and whoever else it takes and then send X on the goddamn bill.
But what about New Orleans? New Orleans, that happened too with BP. You know, clean up your own mess. And then they do ads. We're with the community.
Beyond petroleum.
Bad people.
Except in New York City. If we have a flood in the basement of Clinton Street because the rain is coming down so hard and the drains can't take all that rain at once, and then I have to call Roto-Rooter to snake out the drains, my landlord won't pay for a fucking dime. Mm-hmm. So the tenant's responsibility, not the owner of the building, mm-hmm. whose drains aren't either large enough or clean enough to handle the amount of rain we're getting. Mm-hmm. The tenant pays. Well, so in that case, I have to pay it because it's in my lease and it's in the contract and it's because...
So you pray for sun, not rain.
Right, you pray for sun. By the way, he mentioned New York.
We're like all on attack mode when it starts to rain really hard, just like the other day.
Dude, you're wearing a Mets shirt. You pray for rain all the time.
Now, I'll say Greenpoint
he
had...
He has a Knicks shirt on.
Orange and blue. I got the orange and
the
blue.
The Greenpoint had a spill. It's called, I forget the name of that little river, and I know the cancer rates are very high there. I mean, it's almost so terrible to say you don't even want to say it. I don't even think it's publicized.
I thought it was Gowanus.
Gowanus is a Superfund site, but something terrible happened there in Greenpoint. I think it was Exxon, too, as an oil spill. Very high cancer rates amongst that, much higher than in the rest of the nation and stuff like that. I mean, these are terrible things. I mean, terrible. Those are so deeply wrong. I mean, people are dying because of it. So it's Newton Creek, Newtown Creek, it's called. I mean, look it up.
I think it divides between Long Island City.
All right, take us to Sesame Street and Starbucks and stuff. This is so depressing.
Well, I was just going to, you know, quickly, more like a news little factoid, since I don't think everyone had enough coffee this morning. Starbucks is officially opening in Italy, in Milan. Ooh. So believe it or not, 35 years ago, a visit to Milan is what inspired Starbucks
Howard
Schultz, thank you.
From my neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Yeah? Yep. Well, also,
he grew up in the system.
Did he bring you on this trip to Milan 35 years ago that inspired him to transform Starbucks?
Mm-mm. Are you a Starbucks like frequent buyer or something?
Absolutely not. We're another place we're not allowed to go to. We'll allow ourselves not to go to.
About it quickly, but the only thing to say is, so this is actually, even though Italy inspired him to transform Starbucks 35 years ago, they're only just opening now. It's one of the 3 Starbucks to be called Reserve Roastery, and it's opening in Milan, and it's definitely trying to bear resemblance to the small cafes that Italians go to, but the price is about a euro higher. So it said, the article was saying that the average price of an espresso is 1.16 or 1 euro, and this is going to be 1.80 euro, which is $2.10. So.
But I would like to make note, it has opened 28,000 stores in 77 markets before they decided to go to Italy. So they know that that's not their prime market. Well, they know this is going to be tough.
I like that they charge that much for the coffee. That's about the only thing I like. I will say this, and the only thing I have to say about this story is Carla Petrini said every time we would drive by a Starbucks, this was many years ago, you know, we'd be driving around like America in 2002 and one, he would look in every Starbucks he would see, he would be like, the Italians are such a bunch of idiots, because it was theirs to own. Coffee bar on every neighborhood was for the Italians, by the Italians, and no one ever did it. Illy never did it. Lavazza never did it. And they lost out. So some American who has no history with coffees from Canarsie, Brooklyn, ends up being a coffee thing. So it's, now they're moving, but that's probably why it took them so long to open.
I think the only thing that's ever come out good come out of Starbucks is the bathroom.
Yeah, no, you can pee everywhere.
Honestly, you know that, you know, if you really have to go, you go to a Starbucks.
Now, Mike met his, he was sitting in a Starbucks, and you met your girlfriend who was sitting at a Starbucks kitty corner to you, a different Starbucks right across the street. You guys saw each other and then started to go out. Is that true?
Yeah, that's different, right. Starbucks. I saw her. She was wearing like a little foam mustache.
Oh my god!
I don't go to Starbucks either, by the way. I think it's ridiculous, the whole concept. I don't like the people that go to Starbucks. I don't like being in there. I don't like the environment. I don't like the way it smells. I'm not in love with their coffee.
Their food is terrible.
Oh my god! It's
unnecessarily.
I will say I have started to take it. So there's a lot of people who like, I don't know. I think it's crazy when people travel to a new city and they go to Domino's or they go to Subway. But there are some people that feel comforted by going to a place that's foreign to them, whether it's in the U.S. or overseas, and finding something familiar. I will say occasionally, like if you're pulling off on the highway in Kansas and I know I want to eat or drink something that I will like enough.
Well, that's why McDonald's Starbucks is definitely too.
Right.
Yeah.
But I tend to turn my nose up at
McDonald's. Anytime I had a resort to going to a Starbucks, I've been disappointed. I mean, I think New Yorkers and Americans these days are so into their coffee, and they have so many specific things about it. I mean, my ritual every day, and you know, I go to my corner place and I have a regular coffee, and then I go to Clinton Street and I have a decaf cortado, and then I go up to community and I have a something else. You know, it's like I know what I like when I like it, and Starbucks does not fit into that profile for me. And I think a lot of people are like me, where they specific about what color they want their coffee, how much cream in it, if it's not, if it's this time of day. And for me, Starbucks is so generic and so oppressive and horrible that the only thing I would do is go to their bathroom.
But I like shitty coffee.
Yeah, in some areas, though, like suburbs, it's like Dunk's or Starbucks are the only options.
Well, Dunkin' Donuts on the road, I like their coffee. I would stop.
McDonald's has good coffee, I've heard.
But Starbucks is doing well. They're on like every corner in Manhattan.
I know. That's how I met. I actually was at a third Starbucks on that same
corner. Oh, my God. The stars aligned.
And I saw them meet.
All right, wait. This is a good one. We have to get this one in.
Well, let's stop the cookbook one question, but let's do this one. Yeah, we need to give ourselves time. Mike's ready to go on this.
Emmy award-winning Sesame Street writer Mark Saltzman has announced that two of the show's iconic characters were written as a gay couple. Do we know who they are?
Snuffleupagus and Big Bird.
And Bert and Ernie. Bert and Ernie is from the LGBY network. Bert and Ernie are icons of the LGBT community, and this announcement warrants a long overdue coming out party. These two characters are known throughout the world as children's icons and will help parents discuss the LGBT community with children at a young age, all the while allowing children to express themselves freely. So, what would you serve for the coming out party for Bert and Ernie?
Okay.
Like, if you were bidding to get the gig.
I reject the premise of this question because it supposes that there is something that exists as gay food. Okay? No, seriously, I think this is a ridiculous question. I should bring them quiche and mimosas so that I can reinforce some gay stereotype. Is this really any better than if a couple of African Americans were having a party and I brought them a watermelon? I'm telling you, it's the same kind of garbage and I'm not buying into it. What you gotta do is you gotta ask Bert and Ernie what they would like.
That's true.
Well, I know one thing Bert does not want to eat is pigeon. He does not want to eat pigeon because that's his favorite animal.
Oh, and they definitely can't have pork. Miss Piggy would be offended.
I was thinking cookies in honor of the Cookie Monster.
I always suspected that Miss Piggy was Jewish, which is irony. Then that's irony. Well, she reminds me of Barbara Streisand.
That's irony. Banana splits.
I think it all depends on when the celebration is, because you know we have to cook seasonally, and if it's in the summer, we're gonna do things with tomatoes and peaches and basil and corn.
Fresh, well-sourced,
local.
That's right. The same as you would do for any
heritage meat. They would have heritage meat. Yeah.
Same as you would give any other Muppet. Okay? Just because they're gay does not presuppose a menu.
And just because it's Miss Piggy doesn't mean we can't have ribs, honestly.
She's an open-minded woman.
And Big Bird would not be okay with heritage turkey being served.
No, yeah.
We have to be very selective. Really? We cannot eat their friends.
That's why I asked this question.
Fried chicken?
I don't know. Delicious. I think you have
buttermilk fried chicken.
And then maybe you can't eat cookies. Cookie Monster would be upset.
Well, you can serve orange juice even with
Grover. He's not made of cookies. Like Miss Piggy is like made of ribs and pork chops.
Well, this is a controversial question for sure, but we need to take a quick break. And
this
then
assumes
that
the Cookie Monster isn't gay or Big Bird isn't gay or retarded for that matter.
That's the second time you've dropped that.
Have your signs picked up? I mean, have your children picked up on this? Are you going to discuss this?
Big Bird is a little special needs. I mean, come on, tell me that big yellow freak is not.
Okay, you just said you didn't want to be politically incorrect with having coming out parties. No, gay food.
No, I just said there's no such thing. I never said politically correct. I just said that there's no such thing as gay food.
All right, well, one community likes you, another does not.
Mike cannot get everyone on his side.
All right. So we'll be back.
I am what I am. That's
Vitor,
all that I am.
Take it away and edit that out.
Cut Mike off.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
We're back. This is the Hey No More Chitter Chatter. This is the main course OG airing live. Good point. Good point.
What is we this, are the Bert and Ernie coming out party? Come on, down to business.
Yeah. All right. This is the main course OG airing live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, here at Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. So we're going to jump right into the weekly grill. We've had on our panel today Neil Kleinberg, who is the co-owner of Clinton Street Baking Company and Community Food and Juice. Neil raised himself in the crazy kitchen in Flatbush, Brooklyn, amongst four kids, two parents, 16 neighborhood cousins, and six aunts and uncles.
Whoa.
And he's here to tell us a little bit about his background with that crazy family.
I survived.
And where he is now. Neil, name a mentor.
Guy Pouche. He was my first chef.
That's gay.
He was my first
not
chef.
Jewish.
French chef. Who was the, you know, the chef of the water club in the 80s. Hmm. And he just inspired me. He had such an amazing discipline about him, you know. His regiment, his importance of quality. He was a phenomenal organizational chef. He knew how to take, you know, we were going to do 700 covers on Mother's Day. And he would sit in his office, and I was like his sous chef kind of little kid. I was like, you know, 25 or something. And he would calculate on the, you know, on his little calculator how many portions of swordfish we were going to sell, how many filet mignons, how many roast chicken, how many orders of crab cakes. And he would do all of the math in front of me.
On a napkin or something?
Yeah, like on the back of a menu. And he would say, Neil, this is the way you do it. You know, this is how you figure it out. And if you have a little leftover, you know, you run it tomorrow as the special for lunch and blah, blah, blah. And so, like, he was my mentor, and he was so regimented. Every single day at 6 o'clock, he would...
P.M.?
Yeah, 6 p.m. before service, before we opened for dinner, he would take a folding table, put a white tablecloth on a beautiful bottle of Burgundy, and he would have his dinner, and then he would go home, and I would run the kitchen the rest of the night. So he was there at like 8 in the morning, but at 6, he had his dinner in the back, and I would cook it, or one of the cooks would cook it, or we would try out a new, you know, guy on the line and say, make ghee a duck, you know, make ghee a, you know, a veal chop, or make ghee the...
No, which restaurant was this? Was Simon's?
This was the Water Club.
Oh, this was the Water Club. Okay.
Was he a great chef too, or just a great organizer?
He made some really great things. He made classic French stuff. You know, he made tripe. He braised things beautifully. He was a really great chef, but really of the old school.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive. He lives
on
Long Island. We haven't kept in touch in about 10 years, but I was at his 65th birthday party at the Mark Hotel.
Very cool.
And he's just, you know, he was a guy that every time I refer, you know, when I'm working with my chef and I'm working with guys in the kitchen, I say, this is how you do it.
Most people never go above 14th Street. You never go below 77th Street. How has what's considered good food changed since you opened your first restaurant, Simon's, in Lincoln Center in the 1930s? Just kidding, 1970s or 80s. And even more recently in 1997 when you reopened the legendary seafood restaurant Lundy's in your native Brooklyn.
Well, you know, I think there are certain things in me, like I'm very classically trained and I'm not very modern as far as my food and my tastes and my cooking and my upbringing and all of that. But I like to put twists on things. I like to add another ingredient besides what's like in season. I like to maybe turn something on its head, you know, instead of grilling something, try poaching it or try, you know, doing it cold or what about this? And, you know, so I'm like challenging myself, my chefs, my cooks, my partner, my wife, you know, we're like constantly batting things around, but it basically boils down to like the classics with a twist, with very seasonal stuff, you know, with very
What's a classic? I mean, give us a list. I mean, I know.
You know, crab cakes with a remoulade sauce, like a beautiful combination of like really good crab meat, not bound with a lot of bread or filler, but with just like some shallots and chives and a little lemon and salt and pepper. And then a remoulade sauce, like a classic Louisiana remoulade, like not a Russian dressing, but like a homemade mayonnaise with a little sour cream and Tabasco and Worcestershire. And then when you put that together with a crab cake, you get that subtleness with the little spice and the little tang. Those classic kind of things. When we talked about Instagram earlier, it was like, we're not into piling food up so high to make it look so disgusting and so ridiculous that you don't want to eat it. It's just, you know, going back to basics and eating delicious food, something that's put in front of you that you really want to enjoy. Instead of thinking about it so much.
Right.
Speaking of piling pancakes, tell us about brunch at Clinton Street Baking Company.
It's the number one brunch spot in New York, arguably, you know, with Barney Greengrass. I mean, it's in the top. You only need one hand. Clinton's going to be on that.
How long is your waiting list every Saturday morning?
Hours.
We do between 600 and 700 people every Saturday and Sunday.
When they hold a table for me, they held a table once, like fights break out. They're like, there's a two-top there. Why is it still there? And then I come traipsing in and go sit in it. That happened once on my birthday. They bought me
We tell family and friends, don't come on the weekends. Come during the week. Come for dinner. Come and get pancakes at night. Come during, you know, Saturday and Sunday. It's just so fucking crazy. Yeah. But we have such an amazing team, and we have such a great system. It's kind of like flawless. We're amazed sometimes. Dee Dee and Jade and I go out to a restaurant. There'll be like 20 people in the dining room, and we can't get like our appetizer. Or our server comes up to us and says, "Hi, I'm Jake. I'm going to serve you tonight. But that's your busboy over there, Dick, and that's your hostess over there. But if you need an extra napkin, just feel." Yeah, it's like enough.
Come on.
So we're humbled. We're also really dedicated to making sure people that are coming for brunch are getting served fast. They're getting, you know.
It's a huge menu, too.
Yeah, someone's getting a drink for them immediately. Yeah. They have coffee on the table. The water's there, you know.
That is so underestimated. Waiting a half hour for a drink. I'm like, I'm done here. If it's morning, I want a coffee. If it's night, I want a fucking cocktail.
Right.
I don't want to wait 20 minutes to get drunk, especially if I'm sitting with someone, you know, that I'm not so excited to be with, in-laws or whatever. I want my drink.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody went to brunch anymore, it being so popular and all.
Well,
to paraphrase Yogi Berra, but I haven't had brunch in years.
We don't
for
even
that exact
focus.
Reason.
We don't even focus on that. We really focused on breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then brunch is kind of like.
I mean, I've not gone to brunch in New York City like since I was like 19 years old because I just don't feel like dealing with the punters.
The number one food in the world for me, which you kindly brought bagel, cream cheese, and all that, lox. But you also have burgers, and I mean, you have pancakes, the best pancakes in the city.
We smoke our own salmon in-house. We get heritage ham for our country breakfast. We make our own biscuits. We make our own raspberry jam. We do everything that we possibly can from scratch if it's not Hellman's. You know what I mean? Like, we'll use Hellman's because it's delicious in our tartar sauce, but we'll make our own raspberry jam. We'll, you know, bake biscuits every day. Pancake batter is made like 10 times a day.
And your people change. The worker, I mean, we talked to the same guy for decades at both your restaurants, you know.
Shout out to Juan at Clinton, Manny at Community.
Juan, Manny, Pedro, Gladys, Santa. These people have grown kids. And they started 17, 18 years ago with us as our barista, as a busser, as a waiter. Now, Santa and Gladys are assistant managers now and stuff like that. But it's really a well-oiled machine, and that's how we serve so many people so fast, and that's how the pancakes are so consistent, and that's why, you know, the ham is delicious and the bacon and the biscuits and all of that stuff. We're constantly building like on the classics, and we're constantly focused. Like every day I go back into the kitchen with Juan and say, we're going to do Taco Tuesday night. So our grilled fish tacos are a little too like simple and delicious and kind of dietetic. Let's do, besides a grilled fish taco, let's do a fried fish taco. Mm-hmm. So last night we were in, you know, doing the beer batter, and we were figuring out which fish, of course, cod is the best. And then what kind of sauce are we going to put with this? So we said, we don't want to do like it's the same chipotle this and then that. So we're making our own hot sauce now. We called it a red jalapeno crema. So we're taking our homemade hot sauce, red jalapenos, with a little lime juice and cumin, and mixing it with sour cream. And it really goes well with the fried fish taco because it's crispy and rich and whatever, and you need something to cut it.
Sign me up for Taco Tuesday. So, this sounds amazing.
I want to come for dinner tonight with the kids. Anne has abandoned me. Can I come in to dinner?
Of course. Yeah, are you open? 5:30. Yeah, all right, perfect. Absolutely.
I'm going to go home, bring the kids. I'm going to bring them
I'll
tonight.
Be like Geek
Anyone
Poosh.
Want to come with me?
If we have any radio fans that want to see Patrick, come see him at Clinton Street tonight.
Well, now someone could try to
he
kill me.
He will be holding court.
I'll have Juan make you the fried fish tacos.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. I love Neil so much. I love terroir, you know, which is the terroir of the mind. And I find Italian men and Jewish men of his age, you know, late 50s, to be very attractive, but also to be so filled with terroir. They're like sponges for this stuff. There's a culture there that just doesn't exist in a lot of places. It's so exciting to talk to you. Can you tell us some mysteries about Baking Time Out? Just came out with their top like 275 bakeries in New York City. What is the secret of baking? What's smart baking? What's bad baking? Where are mistakes made? Because you call yourself a baking company.
You know, I started out as a savory chef. I went to culinary school for classic French cuisine. I always cooked savory food. I was the poissonnier here, the saucier there, this and that, a butcher, a fishmonger, all of that stuff like I did. And then I kind of, over the years, collected all these like baking recipes that I always liked to tinker and bake, but I wasn't like a pastry chef. And then I started to develop a couple of my own recipes, the biscuit recipe and the scones, and one of my, I stole a scone recipe from my chef, Ernie, who I asked him, and he's credited in the cookbook for the scone recipe and stuff like that. But I kind of think, I thought about it on the way over here, that baking is a little more disciplined, right? You follow how many grams and how many cups and this and that, and then a lot of people forget about the steps. You know, they forget, like, when it says cream the butter and sugar, cream the fucking butter and sugar. Don't take a shortcut. Really get it to that point where the butter turns white and the sugar dissolves and it's very creamy. And there's a reason for that. When it goes in the oven and it bakes and you fold in your flour and your baking powder or whatever, that's what makes the stuff, like, airy and fluffy and also imparts a lot of flavor because the sugar is almost dissolved. So I was thinking about all those kind of steps. Yet, I'm also thinking about flavor. If we're making a lemon pound cake, before the pound cake batter goes into the oven, I'm tasting it. I'm saying, is there enough lemon juice in this? Is there enough lemon zest in it? Is there enough vanilla in this? Like, to, you know, in the raw batter how it's going to come out when it's cooked, because you can't fix it once it's cooked.
Right.
You can't like infuse or inject lemon juice in it, even though after the pound cake is cooked or baked, we roll it around in a lemon slurry, which is lemon juice and sugar and vanilla until it soaks in. So that when you cut a piece of lemon pound cake, you really get the lemon.
See, this is smart. These are smart people.
You know, just
a lot of the times we ask people questions, I'm like, I'm not satisfied with that response.
Baking, I'm always fascinated by the spoons, but that's kind of like probably a drug thing.
What do you mean the spoons?
Oh my God.
Like, you know, like for home cooking.
The measuring spoon. I'm totally.
I've always been fascinated.
I'm totally into that.
I know. It's like, I'm not a good baker, but yeah, the spoons kind of are turned on after
so
that.
So go to Clinton Street, not just for brunch. The big secret there is to go for dinner, where you
Taco
still have
Tuesday.
Access to the whole menu. But no, but everything
breakfast
on there
dinner
is
also
well considered. Everything
there
is a classic.
You can still try their pancakes and their biscuits in the evening.
Yeah, and our burgers
and
are amazing.
To wait.
And our fried chicken.
It was National Cheeseburger Day. I saw you post.
Yes.
And we're big fans of Dee Dee, who also is high in terroir. She is the, you know what terroir is. It's the terroir
of the brain.
Exactly.
Well, I have to give a shout out to Dee Dee because she's what inspires
engine.
Me.
Yeah.
She is my muse.
Yes. She's your Ernie.
She's my Bert.
All right, Bert. So thank you, Neil Kleinberg. Thank you, Libby. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Vitor. And stay tuned for Tech Bites with Jen Luisi.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. With me riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow.